I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives.
Correct. Oh, we started now. Yes.
Yes, of course we've started.
I'd been working at the Playbox Theatre, and I'd worked as an ASM on a show, a Louis Nara show, The Golden Age.
The golden years of Hollywood. That was what I loved.
Absolutely don't profess to be good at it at all. I could study and I could be much more diligent in my homework.
So in a sense, you know, I think really good directors are really good editors.
I was really incapable of going on, not just as a writer, but I felt as if I was incapable of going on as a human.
One more day before the storm. And Trevor says, stop. He said, you look like little Lord Fauntleroy, dip the wig.
They swooped in and just... Every scene I had with all those different people, they just made it work.
But after some time, I realised that grey comes in many, many hues.
I've had the luck, and without the luck, I know plenty of entertainers out there that are wonderful, funny, just never had the breaks.
I'm what I would call a dancer's dancer. Like, all I ever wanted to do was dance.
You've got a better memory than me, that's for sure.
Oh, I've done my research. I've cheated.
And you'd had a little piece of paper there, mind you, so have I.
We both had pieces of paper, so that's been
alright. I wasn't silly, was I?
No, I think it was great. Yeah. Thank you, Sheila.
Thank you, Peter. God bless.
Hello, dear listener, and welcome to the Stages podcast. I'm Peter Ayers. If I may commence this episode 476 with a small request, ratings and reviews help the podcast be seen in a wider audience. So if you could take some time at the conclusion of this episode, it'd be much appreciated if you would rate and review the podcast. You can do so at the bottom of the application where you found this particular episode. Thank you. Damien Ryan is my guest today. He is the Managing Director and Artistic Director of Sport for Jove Theatre Company. Heading into its 15th year, he has directed more than 30 productions for the company, written and developed 3 new works, and adapted over a dozen plays. The company has a comprehensive education program developed by Damien and works with tens of thousands of Australian students annually at secondary and tertiary levels. Damien has worked extensively with Shakespeare, performing in or directing over 70 productions in Australia and overseas, and has worked as actor, director and writer across Australia's main stage companies and in the independent sector in Sydney. From May 1st to June 1st, Sport for Jove's production of Isolde and Tristan plays the Old Fitz Theatre in Sydney, and it is directed by today's featured guest, Damien Ryan. Damien Ryan, welcome to the Stages podcast.
Thank you for having me, Peter.
you're about a week away from production of Isolde and Tristan, which is going to take place at the Old Fitz. Describe for me what's going through a director's head this stage of the process.
That's a very, very good question. It's wonderful. It's a little like how could I describe it? Maybe like one of those nightmares where you've got a quilt over you, and no matter where you pull the quilt, you can't quite keep everything warm. You know, I mean, either a foot's poking out, your arm's cold, your head's cold. You just can't quite get comfortable in the final week as a director. I kind of love that feeling. It never goes away, no matter how many shows you've done, of just so many different elements trying to come together at the same time, you know, trying to see what sound and lighting design are going to do to the show, aware that the actors are feeling now extraordinarily comfortable in the storytelling, but in the wrong room, without a set that's going to be a floating rake in the middle of a dark space with a slippery floor. All that you realise that every element's going to be new to them within a couple of days' time, and everything they thought they felt comfortable with is going to be gone. Costume, the sound of the pub next door raining into the room when we've got this extraordinary delicate piano piece in the opera. It's all of those things that are just kind of exciting but debilitating at the edge of the mind. So that's kind of where I am, but very excited. The cast are wonderful, and the music is so extraordinary, and it's really a great joy to work on.
Yeah, there's so much learning that takes place in those final moments, the final week.
Yeah,
final
there really days. Is. Yeah. Yeah, it's sort of where you learn what the play's about. You think you know. You obviously study and research copiously before you go into a show, and you build a kind of framework of understanding. But it's funny how often during the run or right at the back end when you've already written something like your program note, you kind of go, oh, that's what this is about. That's where this works. That's where its humanity sits. So, yeah, it's been great this week, kind of really, really watching the play unfold and starting to get a sense of its scope and its journey and its kind of the cleverness of it. I think I'd underestimated in some ways the cleverness of what the playwright's done with this play.
Tristan and Isolde is a narrative trope that's been around for centuries.
Yes.
But this particular play is called Isolde and Tristan. Isolde gets sort of main billing.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So is there's a shift of perspectives there for the
it
characters?
It is.
Or?
Yeah, it is. There's sort of a line at the end where she says how crude must... where Isolde herself says how crude must people be to believe in such love stories. And Esther Villa is a feminist writer from Germany, and she left Germany and during, you know, the mid 20th century kind of crises, and ended up in Ireland, and she saw an interesting synergy between the oppression of the Irish people by the English historically and the Jewish people by the Germans in that mid 20th century period, and she sort of wrote a play exploring that and exploring the unlikelihood of Isolde falling for Tristan. Genuinely falling for Tristan, who was the murderer of her betrothed, of course, and the oppressor of her nation. And so she wanted to kind of write a play that sat in a beautifully ambiguous space where the audience aren't quite aware if she's playing a long game revenge here or genuinely falling for Tristan. And hopefully, you know, in a good production of it, we're not sure, as the actor's not sure herself in the study of the story, you know, where her heart is and where her feelings are. But in the end, she's kind of revising the great myth and speaking back to Wagner in some ways, who's written one of the most extraordinary visions of this particular myth in his opera, by allowing Isolde to essentially destroy Tristan while loving him. And so it's got a kind of... it's as if Juliet answered back personally to Verona in some way, you know.
It's a co-production between Sport for Jove and The Olfitz.
Yes, that's right.
And we know The Olfitz is a charming theatre space, but it's tiny.
Yes.
So how do you tell an epic story?
Yeah, that's a great
on a
question.
Tiny stage.
Well, that and it's great. And I've so rarely worked there too, so I'm very excited about working at the Fitz. I've only ever done one play there. I've never acted there. It's a strange sort of anomaly. But very excited to be working there. The smallness of it, I thought, suited this beautifully because it is a three-hander. For half the play, it's a two-hander. And it's extremely intense and extremely personal. It's quite an erotic drama. It's a dangerous drama. The language is very sparse. It's very spare. The scenes are brief and cut very suddenly by a series of almost televisual blackouts that kind of carry the narrative along. And so it's got this kind of heartbeat of intensity about it. And I think it only really suits quite a small space. And it's partly drawn from when I was, many years ago, 27 years ago or so, I acted in the play, in the only other Australian production playing Tristan. And we played it in the tiny Lookout Theatre. I'm not sure if you remember the Lookout Theatre.
In
Willara.
Yeah, that was a great space.
Great little space. And that's where wonderful David Ritchie and Gertrude Ingeborg directed that production. And it was, the intensity of it was wonderful. And the audience, I remember it sold out for 6 or 7 weeks and the audience loved it. And so I always thought, oh, we have to bring that back at some point. I'll do a new production of that. And so I kind of wanted to find a small space. And when the Fitz had a spot available, along with the thought of having some opera, some live opera in a tiny room, there's something thrilling about that, you know, where you sit back and just go, wow. Listen to this extraordinary voice of Octavia Baron Martin and an exquisite, exquisite piece of music for all of Wagner's politics, of course. The music of this particular opera is incredible, the way it never resolves itself, continuously tense until the very end of the opera. And that's sort of how the play should feel too.
So the music being used in, is that the Wagner?
Yeah, it's Wagner's music, cool. Yeah. Sections of the Prelude, the Overture, the Song of the Young Sailor, it's called, and of course the Love Death, the Liebestod, that finishes, which is just a miraculous piece of music. And we have a live singer, someone from your neck of the woods, Skeggs, a former student, Octavia Baron Martin, and she sings the major Wagnerian pieces in this tiny room.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Can't wait to see it. Of course, you're an artistic director and managing director of Sport for Joe,
yeah,
company, very much in the the train of people like Herbert Beerbohm-Tree,
the actor managers.
Which is great. And talking to you today, I start to think about my first exposure to Shakespeare, and I think it probably wasn't until about year 10.
Yeah.
And we saw a film of Romeo and Juliet, Zeffirelli's.
Zeffirelli's one, yes.
Leonard Whiting and Olivia Hussey, which amazing. I just thought was just spellbinding.
Absolutely transporting, wasn't it?
Yeah. What about yours? What was yours?
Well, similarly, actually, I had put in my mind a memory I've not thought of for a long time, actually. I remember maybe I was 13 or so. I remember sitting up late at night, and my mother was a teacher, and she was watching Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet. And I remember I came in, it's palpable to me, tangible memory, of sitting down in a lounge in Punch Bowl and seeing a... seeing the scene where the singer sings What Is a Youth, you know, that incredible song where Romeo and Juliet first see each other, having no idea what this was, having never heard of Shakespeare or thought about Shakespeare, and being transfixed for about an hour watching it, watching those two fall in love, watching the scene where Romeo runs through the fields after the balcony scene, that extraordinary moment of filmmaking, and being... having a strange feeling that there was something terribly important about this, and bombarding my mother with questions about what this is and why it's strange, and she made to go to bed before the nude scene. That was infuriating. But and then didn't sort of think much about Shakespeare beyond that, but it always stuck in my head, and I had a wonderful teacher. It's so often the way, isn't it? As I'm sure the effect you have on your students, the effect of teachers is perpetual and eternal in a way, isn't it? And had a wonderful teacher out at Mount Druitt called Kay Boaz, an incredible English teacher. And she just illuminated these texts for me and, you know, probably two other kids in the room who would bother listening to her. It's a tough old school. It was something about the way she revered the unlocking of poetry and made one feel so thrilled by the, you know, the exponential meanings that come from poetry, the ambiguity of it, the sense of dimension of multiple meanings. That way you kind of, you feel enlivened when something explodes in front of you to comprehension. You know, there's something incredible about that, and that's what I've loved most about teaching myself, and having worked with all sorts of different types of people all over Australia on Shakespeare, it's that excites me when you see them, whether they're young or whether they're, you know, inmates at Silverwater Jail, or whether they're young actors or even older actors coming to something and watching something burgeon and open up in front of them. That feeling has never left me. That joy that she gave me has never left me. And pedagogically, it's, I guess, what keeps me going in the education sphere with texts like this. So it kind of began slowly for me. It was more about poetry and less about acting, but once I entered the industry, it kind of became my focus, I suppose.
Yes, we've got a great responsibility as teachers, and also a very privileged position in that we can impart that passion and love for the arts on our students.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it really is valuable. It really is. I mean, most artists at some point will say that there was a teacher who was seminal in their development, you know.
You talk about the meeting of Romeo and Juliet in that Zeffirelli film. Lerman does a similar thing in his film, you know, when they're meeting near the fish tank.
Yes, that's right.
But there's also that wonderful black singer who's performing a disco anthem from the time as well.
Yeah.
And that's indelible on my mind also. Shakespeare on film, does it generally work?
It's funny, isn't it? I think it can, and I think there's several absolutely wonderful examples. And it, in some ways, I think the trickiest thing to do is to capture that theatrical magic on film. I think the successful films tend to be the ones that go fully cinematic and filmic in the dramaturgy of the play, which does involve really moving away from what Shakespeare was, you know, trying to do theatrically. There are examples, though, where I think wonderful productions have morphed into films but I think in a way, I don't know how much broad appeal they'd find, but there's a Fiona Shaw, Richard II, for example. I'm not sure if you've ever seen that. That is just an extraordinary piece of work, the simplicity of it. Or Ian Holm's King Lear, I think, is a very, very good film. Even the Olivier King Lear, I find kind of fascinating to watch. Mm-hmm. They're simple. They feel like a theatre show unfolding in front of you, where the kind of conventions and artifacts of Shakespearean theatre are still present in the way the story is being told.
And because Olivier was the age of King Lear at the time,
that's right.
Film allowed him to physically
perform
that role.
And not have to hit the back of a 3,000-seat house or something. Yeah. That's exactly right. Whereas I think what people like Zeffirelli and Lerman, and look, Branagh's Much Ado. I mean, I remember sitting in a cinema out in Sydney's West where I live and listening to 300 people absolutely pissing themselves in that cinema at that film, thinking it was glorious, hilarious, sexy, funny. I remember thinking, this is quite an achievement. You know, you've got a crowd in Western Sydney and Sydney absolutely enthralled by this Branagh. And similarly, when I saw his Henry V in the cinema, I thought that was a remarkable achievement. Again, it was so filmic, so clever, the language so intense and up close. You got Judi Dench, you know, camera zeroing on her face, delivering a magnificent piece of text. There's some really great examples of it. Sometimes I think the danger of film, I think, is it can, and there's many examples of this, I think it can push actors toward thinking they won't heat up the internal kind of metal of the text enough, and they'll speak at a whisper and pull it back to something very quiet that, and often very slow, and also the text tends to get cut down to its bare minimum. And I think sometimes that can be kind of infuriating. There's lots of examples of Shakespeare films that just never come alive, and they're all kind of style over substance, and I think that's the challenge.
Mm. Well, there was that series of Shakespeare performances, the Dench and McKellen Macbeth,
yes,
which I think was a stage production.
It
wasn't
was
it?
Absolutely, yeah.
But they filmed it. But it's very whispered.
That is, yeah, that's right. But they, but there's an example. Compare that to the Macbeth with Michael Fassbender and French actor, wonderful Oscar-winning actor from La Vie en Rose, Marion Cotillard. Incredible cast. Justin Kurzel, I think, directed it. Amazing visuals. Incredible visuals. But the text is just never alive. It's spoken at a hushed, terribly earnest kind of self-important whisper that might have felt like a good idea in the room, but there's absolutely no transference through the screen. But you look at McKellen and Dench and Trevor Nunn's 1976 production that you're speaking of at the other place in Stratford, and the intensity of it, the kind of internal combustion of it. In fact, McKellen says a quote that I think every young actor should study. He talks about acting Shakespeare being a bit like having a stereotype, you know, like they might use in a printer's house back in the day, a metal kind of dish cut with 100 different grooves that you have to pour molten metal into to create, you know, a form. And he says that Shakespeare is like that process. All the grooves, all the kind of initiated surfaces that could bring your performance to life are all waiting for you in the text. And you've got to heat your internal kind of molten metal up to the point that when you pour yourself into a Shakespeare play, you flow into every possible, you know, access point or corner of that form. And if you don't heat it up enough, if your thoughts aren't clear enough, if you haven't done the research, if you haven't done the work, if you're not living in the language enough, if you don't have that internal energy, you'll just fill out a few stereotypical parts of that. You won't push yourself to the full archetype, you know. And I kind of love that. I think that's true. And that's what he and Dench do so remarkably in that film, is they really push themselves to the limit, even though they're conscious of the proximity of the camera. And I love that.
Well, fortunately, there's enough good films of Shakespeare performances.
Yes. Yeah.
For those students, teachers, who can't access a live production, the film is always a good fallback.
Yeah,
but of course you've rectified a lot of that for schools within Sports for Joe's own education wing. Presenting texts for students.
It's sort of the backbone of our company, really. It's obviously, you know, where my passion has always lain since the very beginning of my career in theatre. When I was in my early 20s, I was already desperately trying to talk to schools about opportunities to speak to students about these plays. I think it's a tough gig, I think, particularly being an English teacher, and the country is full of extraordinary English teachers, but the job of teaching Shakespeare in a classroom, I think, could not be more intimidating or challenging, even for those that absolutely love it and have no fear of it. And there are plenty of teachers that do, because I've spoken to hundreds of them that are intimidated by it and are fearful of it. and often from their own experiences of learning it, you know, whether it be tertiary or secondary. And it's a bit like, the best example, metaphor I'd heard from a teacher was one who said that it's like we have the play, yes, but it's like we're handing out just the sheet music to an extraordinary symphony or a Beyonce song, whatever it might be, just the sheet music to the kids and going, here, why don't you like it? Why can't you see that's important? That's Beethoven's Fifth, goddammit. Why aren't you enjoying that, you know, behind your desk reading the sheet music?
Yeah.
It's a lived experience. As we know, Shakespeare probably didn't even bother to publish his own plays in his own lifetime. A few piratical versions, but his mates did that after he died. You know, this was ephemera. This was a living thing. And I just think that if kids, as compulsorily they still have to do, are studying these plays, they have to, absolutely have to have access to dynamic and passionate productions of them in the theatre. And so that's, I guess, what we're trying to be as partners to teachers, to kind of go, yes, you can read it in class, of course, but come along and look at interpretation as well. Come along and look at the way actors' choices influence the text, directors' choices, but just hear some of it, meet the characters. You know, that's kind of the essence of what we do, I think.
Sport for Jove, it's a quote from Othello.
Yeah, it is indeed.
How did you arrive at the name for the company?
Yeah. Terry Karabellis and I were actually sitting in a pub when we came up with that name. I think he said it first. He was one of the co-founders of the company and wonderful teacher himself. And we were kind of wearing our hearts on our sleeve in a way. Our two of our favourite theatre companies were Theatre de Complicité and Cheek by Jowl. And we loved the name Cheek by Jowl, which of course was someone I streamed. And we loved its energy and its kind of cheekiness and its playfulness. And we wanted a name that had a kind of dynamism and a rapidity to it or something. And we had a dozen different phrases like that from Shakespeare and a couple of Greek plays that we were tossing around. And when we came across Sport for Jove, we loved the thought of, firstly, and this was genuinely, slightly jokingly, but kind of genuine, part of our thinking at the time was that, well, the name Sport's in the title, and this is Australia, so we might get some accidental hits on Google. Yeah. You know? But we love the thought of the energy of it, Cheek by Jowl, Sport for Jowl. We loved its strangeness. We loved that people would go, what is it? What? We didn't predict that every journalist would call us Sport by Jove every time they reviewed us, right. And that took a long time to cure itself. But we liked the thought of theatre kind of is the sport of the gods, as it were. We are, you know, as wanton flies to boys are we to the gods kind of thing. And so we liked that thought of this kind of, this idea of humanity in the face of a bigger thing, the idea that we're the sport of the gods kind of thing in the ancient sense. So we, the range of esoteric reasons why we liked it, but it just stuck and people seemed to like it. And we loved how quickly we just got called Jove, and then actors who worked with us adopted the moniker amongst themselves that they were Jovians, and kind of and we steadily became a cult, which is
fantastic. And you're the leader, don't you? Yeah, don't drink the Kool-Aid.
That's right.
So is it a goal to perhaps present the entire Shakespearean repertoire at some point?
Yeah, it is.
Because you're about, how old's the company now?
15 years. 15 years. Yeah. And we've done about 30 of the 37 plays now, so we're kind of getting close. Look, it's not. I guess it's not a... It's not a desperate aspiration. It's not like putting...
Well, some of them aren't box office, I guess.
Well, no, exactly. Yeah. It's not like... It's not a desire to do it out of a sense of just kind of notching that on a wall and going, look, we did. It's more, I'm always fascinated by the plays we never get to see, and they've kind of been the highlights of my personal career as a director or an actor. We see on rotation, when you've got a playwright who has so many hits, like the Beatles or Elvis or something, when you've got Twelfth Night, Midsummer Night's Dream, As You Like It, Romeo and Juliet, Hamlet, King Lear, Julius Caesar, Othello, Macbeth, the list of classic hits is so long, maybe 15 absolutely killer plays that sit in the public consciousness. You want to see actors do them over and over again. You want the best actors of a generation to tackle those plays, so they just get done again and again and again, and they're box office, you know. But the same person who wrote those wrote All's Well That Ends Well. It's just a masterpiece that never done. Timon of Athens, which is an extraordinary draft of King Lear that we just did recently, for example. Love's Labour's Lost, a very hard but incredibly funny play, very rewarding play. Anyway, the list of the Lesson, the Troilus and Cressidas, the Pericles, the Corioluses, they're incredible works of art. The Winter's Tale doesn't get done very often, and what an absolute masterpiece that is. The same mind behind Hamlet coined those. In this country, not so much in England or Canada or America, where they have much bigger, significant relationship to Shakespeare, but in this country, we barely touch those works. And so part of Sport for Jove's charter, I guess, is to try to give opportunities for audiences to see and experience these lesser-known plays. So that's kind of how we are inevitably clambering toward the end of the canon. Henry VIII, I don't imagine we'll ever really get a Guernsey. But King John is a great, very funny play that I think could be very skillfully done. We'll hopefully get close in the next few years.
The wonderful thing about the plays, I think, you know, I've seen A Midsummer Night's Dream 20 productions in my lifetime. But each time you revisit the plays, they can mean something different, depending on how old you are and your life experience.
Yeah.
You relate to a different character.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think that not only will... Yeah, it's beautifully put, actually. Not only do you have a director or an actor's kind of choices and interpretations re-evolving the text in front of you, but the audience is... Everyone's experiencing it differently. And, yeah, Dream is like you've seen so many productions, too many. And yet, I still get a bubble of excitement in me as the lights go down before that play. There's something magic about that play. And its level of learning, its kind of its craftsmanship is so remarkable. But yeah, you do. You sometimes get deeply moved by a Peter Quince, as I was recently, or the frustration of a bottom, or the nature of the fairy kingdom, or maybe it's the love when you're young that you love the lovers and Puck, you know. So yeah, it's so such a full experience.
Love sees with the heart, not with the mind.
Yes,
or as women keep it painted blind.
There it is.
I remember reading that. Oh my God, that makes so much sense.
Your dream of playing Helena. It's never too late.
So is that your favourite? I suppose it's hard.
It is hard to say what's
your favourite child.
Yeah, it's up there. For many years, Othello was a bit of a favourite of mine, just as a play that didn't sort of waste a word. So searingly kind of intense. But that play has come to trouble me more in recent years. Dream, I think, it's almost a shame the way our Victorian relationship to fairies at the bottom of our garden has kind of changed the nature of that very dark, very subversive, really dangerously erotic play. And I think it is one of the greatest works of human art ever recorded, in my opinion, alongside anything that you know, Van Gogh or Da Vinci. Or it's staggering in its learning and its knowledge and its complexity and its use of different variant mythologies from about six different empires historically. The learning behind that play just bewilders me, you know, and I admire it like that. I think it sits alongside Hamlet in that regard.
You must have spent some time with the repertoire, though. Do you return to plays regularly to read?
I read Shakespeare every day. I've never grown tired of it. I read it for a couple of hours every day, actually, and sort of began my career just learning when I didn't know about drama school. I was just a Westie kid in Western Sydney, and I'd open a service station every morning at 5 a.m. and finish work at 10 a.m. So I had the day ahead of me. My parents were out and at work, and my brother was at work, and I would just stand at home and I would just learn Shakespeare monologues. I learned hundreds of them, and I read the canon through and through. From the moment I first looked at it, there was, as I said before about R&J, it felt like something important and significant was being said. I'm always bewildered by this question of relevance in Shakespeare. There's barely a line that is irrelevant. It's about the human species. It x-rays us and the way we think, the way we behave, the way we love and hate and die and live and what we cherish and what we harm about ourselves or others. It's just an extraordinary insight into being human, and that has always struck me. And so I will... I will read it whenever I can. I'll just open the book anywhere and read another scene, and I'm always enlivened by that. So it's a bit of a secular Bible for me, I guess.
It sounds like it's your religion.
Well, in a sense. Yeah, I'm a deep atheist, but I think that spiritual impulse for me is probably somehow found in the kind of strange wisdom of Shakespeare.
And somebody listening might think, that's bizarrely odd for a boy to be learning monologues at home and all that sort of thing. But no more bizarre than a kid obsessed with a football.
Yeah, well, exactly right. Exactly. Yeah, the thrill of those words, those ideas. It's like, I remember listening to a friend describe the thrill of surfing once and what it's like, you know, when you get up and that wave is, the ocean is tremoring behind you like that, and thinking, that's exactly how it feels to begin some extraordinary speech of Shakespeare's and watch the way the thoughts cascade. I just have always loved it.
So did that ignite a passion to want to be an actor? Because you were a journalist, weren't you, for a while?
I was a journo, yeah. Well, I guess what I loved Shakespeare for initially was its writing. I was enamoured of it a long time before I even knew you could be an actor. I didn't know anything about theatre. I didn't go to the theatre. I only had one experience of theatre in my whole kind of childhood. That was a production of Bedroom Farce at Pamo Riverside Theatre that my school went to, and I remember thinking, well, if that's theatre, I think I'll leave that.
I love a farce.
Yeah, oh, I do love a farce. Yeah,
did
love
Shakespeare
farce.
Write any?
Well,
in a farcical form
sense,
for any of the plays.
Yeah, there's elements of it. He certainly
mistaken
had his,
identity.
Yeah, he certainly had his Three Doors, and he certainly had his Comedy of Errors and Merry Wives of Windsor and Love's Labour's Lost to be pretty close to that, where entrances and exits, and the timing of meetings and the disinformation of farce is all located there. And I think Molière certainly would have loved a bit of Shakespeare, and they were all drawing on Commedia dell'arte, which of course has the essence of farce in it. I very much initially wanted to be an actor. Once I'd left school, I was working as a journalist, and I sort of fell into theatre almost accidentally in a way. But I had a love of Shakespeare for several years before that, but as a writer, and I think at my heart, that's what I wanted to be. That's what I spend most of my time doing now. But I went into journalism thinking that was writing, because a lot of my family are journalists, and I just thought, oh, well, that's my fate. That's what I want to do. And it wasn't particularly. And I remember an aunt told me not to be a journalist before I went to university. She was an excellent journalist, and she said, don't do it, Damien. You'll hate it. You will not like it. And I was quite angered by it. What are you talking about? Of course I will. I want to be like my granddad, you know. And she said, no, it's the opposite of writing. You'll hate it. And it took me a few years to learn what she meant, but she was right. For me, I still started to realize that the who, what, where, why, when stuff was the opposite of what I wanted to write, So I left that behind, and when I entered the theatre, yeah.
Did you audition for the drama schools?
Only once. I didn't really know of them. It's strange. I just didn't at all come from theatrical kind of stock or family. I went to school in Mount Druitt, grew up in Punchbowl and Wentworthville and Toon Gabby, and I played sport and I read, and that's all I did. Worked as a journo for a period, and then early after I'd done my first play, I was told about this place called NIDA. Auditions run in a week. I went and auditioned. I didn't get in, and I just kept going to local auditions. Got a job with a theatre company called Nomad, and that was fantastic because it was almost an old school training. It was like a repertory theatre company. We'd do up to 12 plays simultaneously in a 3-month period, and two of them around the country. I was this young actor with all these older actors, and it was a bit like it would have been back in Birmingham Rep or something,
Tell me about Nomad. I've never heard of Nomad.
Yeah.
But who was...
Roxanne Charles was the head of it, and it was a great little theatre company. It was a theatre and education company, and they would tour absolutely everywhere, and they'd do a whole range of plays. Not Shakespeare, interestingly, but basically everything else. So on one morning you'd be performing Pygmalion somewhere, and then a Michael Gow play, and then the next day you'd be doing, a children's play like No Worries, and then Importance of Being Earnest or Bernard Shaw or whatever it might be. And it was great. It was just a great little intense learning experience for a kid.
Best way to learn.
Yeah, it's a great way to learn.
An apprenticeship.
Yeah, that's right.
What about playing Shakespeare for the first time?
Well, that was my, I guess my very first play was Midsummer Night's Dream. That was when I just knew that journalism and music and the other things that I thought I'd wanted to do with my life were not quite it. I had a wonderful director who was a big mentor for me in the early stages of my life, called Robin McLean, and sort of got lucky that there was a professional director working in an amateur theatre company in Castle Hill. And I just went down there and got a role of Lysander in this very small budget play, and it was just a joy. I just remember thinking, this is an amazing experience. When you get that first laugh off an audience, you kind of go, well, this is a good job.
Yep.
And from there, I didn't really stop. And for 30 years, it's sort of all I've done really is work on theatre, which has been great.
Still performing, acting?
Still performing, not as often at the moment. I'll tend to try to do maybe one thing a year. Yeah. So I just most recently played Timon of Athens in our outdoor season, and I probably won't do any other acting this year. But I wish I could kind of get on stage a bit more, but I do love... The whole point of this company is to give emerging artists and experienced artists an opportunity to do these big works of ensemble, these big works of language, and if I can keep sort of facilitating that environment, then I will. And I love directing. I love, you know, working with actors in a rehearsal room, and I'm trying to write a lot more, so I'm kind of just acting occasionally.
I love that you have an outdoors season. Because, of course, the Globe was exposed to the elements.
That's right.
And indeed, he wrote the various acts were to do with the natural light.
Absolutely, yeah. So often he would sort of let the claustrophobia of the late afternoon kind of come in a little bit. Even the way shadow might have played across the space would be interesting, I think. But yeah, they are. There's so many references to the natural elements. And it's funny how you really... I don't know how many times in the 35-odd plays we've done outdoors now... How many times actors say, my God, the continual references to light, to air, to the four elements, to bird life, to animal life is incredible. And to the sounds, the oral experience, the sonic experience of being outdoors. You really do note it when you're acting outdoors because you find yourself just so easily able to reference it. Whereas when you're in that us and their environment of the theatre, you kind of just get caught up in the broader themes and the intensity of the work, and those things almost become... little irrelevancies, but when you're outdoors, they're really, really present in what you're thinking about as an actor.
Yeah. Well, so many of those plays take place in a forest or on a battlefield.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he does use a lot of outdoor spaces, and when he chooses to use an indoor one, it's often the language makes a power, or the dramaturgy of the moment will make a power, will actually involve a powerful sense of describing interiority, or describing proximity, or describing claustrophobia, you know, making clear that Polonius will say three times, I'll be hiding behind this, and you do that, and you know, he'll make a point of going, we are indoors now. But so much of the work, you're right, is outdoors. Hamlet will suddenly describe the sky and ask everyone to look at it, this brave or hanging firmament, this majestical roof. He'll describe it right there, and you can feel the people kind of going, yeah, here we are together, you know.
Wow. That's his longest play, isn't it, Hamlet?
Yeah, certainly in the way... That's sort of one of the questions that I think is toughest for school teachers too, that what we read today in a Cambridge edition or an Oxford or whatever, Penguin, is so far afield from what Shakespeare's company would have performed, in that Hamlet, yes, in its fullness, is 4.5 hours long. Shakespeare would never have performed that play.
Length of time.
It's like, I don't know, you're probably right yourself.
Everyone would be pissed by the time.
Well, that's right. If someone came to my... I'm writing a play at the moment and I've currently got 11 drafts on my computer. Now, if you can imagine 400 years from now, not that they would be looking at my work, but if someone came to those files 400 years from now and got every word I ever wrote on that play from all 11 files and concertinaed them together, trying to find where that one might fit, and gave us that text, it would be this absurd length play. That's precisely what Hamlet is in our contemporary understanding, because compositors have found from at least 2 up to 4 quartos, a first folio, a second folio, a third folio, and a fourth folio, all that are subtly different, every word ever attributed to this play, strung it together as this enormous beast. People like Branner and other people have put the whole thing down to it seems like, okay, so that's an actual thing that exists. Shakespeare's company had to start their plays at about 3 o'clock and stop by 5:30. That was the law by 1594.
Right.
And so the play would have been about 2.5, maybe pushing toward 3 hours at the longest in those plays. And when you look at the First Folio, for example, it's a very different play. It's nowhere near as long as what the compositors have put together now. So it's that funny thing that the kind of bardolatry industry has really built a slightly false relationship to Shakespeare. I think he was better at trimming his darlings than the current editions might seem, you know. So I find that interesting.
Yeah. Interesting also, I find, is that all of his plays are set somewhere different in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, was he much of a traveller? Did he see much of the world?
Well, you know, you get to you ask that question, you light a fire in a way, don't you, for the people who want to have the argument about the authorship, you know, of Shakespeare, because it is intriguing, his knowledge of, particularly of Italy. And there's a broad misnomer that existed for many years, probably 60 or 70 years, that Shakespeare's geography of Italy was so dreadful, so he couldn't have been there. And it is kind of extraordinary how systematically that has been proven untrue, that his knowledge of Italy and its geography and some very particularities of Italian city life and little destinations and places in towns is really remarkable. That does make his, and in fact, all of the things that people said were incorrect about his geographical understanding have actually been proven to be quite wrong. They're contemporary 20th century understandings of things that were very different in the medieval age. And so that I've read a lot about that, and that is interesting. That does make you wonder whether he did visit Italy. That's where, of course, people really jump on the Marlowian bandwagon or the Earl of Oxford kind of bandwagon because of their time in Italy. But I'm a bit agnostic about all of that. But it is the essence of your question, though, is yes, he two clever things I think he does. He's not allowed to write about his own country, and when I say that, he's allowed to write about history, but he's not allowed to write about the present. He's absolutely sedition to write about the present. He literally, there's a law that he cannot make greatness familiar, and Elizabeth wrote into law that in the start of her reign in early, late 1550s, a playwright could not comment on the particular socio-cultural political moment that they lived in without it being cancelled, seditious. Playwrights had their hands cut off. Three were executed in 1592. One went to jail. They had to be very careful. So he would use British history, but fundamentally European transformative journeys to magical places, Bohemia, Sicilia, Italy, France, whatever. Scotland even was like another planet to London. And he would use those places as a bit like Arthur Miller might use Salem, Massachusetts to say something about, you know, about Joseph McCarthy. He was doing very similar stuff, kind of going, well, let's actually examine our court. Let's examine the police state of a realm in a crisis of succession, but let's set it in Denmark and call it Hamlet. People won't necessarily be able to tell me I'm not writing a parable, you know. So I think that's interesting.
And then Hamlet itself has ignited so many other stories and interpretations,
yeah, right.
The Lion King to Sons of Anarchy.
That's right. Yeah, Sons of Anarchy. I've got to watch that. Everyone tells me I've got to watch that.
Absolutely. So he was writing for the people of the time.
Yeah.
And of course, when you're conceiving a production, I guess you're creating a production for the people of the time. And that was demonstrated so excellently in that production of Henry IV that you did with the Bell Company, sending it during the Blitz, in a schoolroom.
Yeah, yeah.
Genius.
Oh, thank you.
How did you arrive at that?
It's going to try to take my mind back to 2014, I think it was. Yeah, John Bell had asked me to direct the play, and he'd done it a few years earlier, maybe 5 or 6 years earlier, with wonderful performance from Joel Edgerton as Henry V, and it had been a production that was sort of set in a war where they really were soldiers and the like, and at the time, of course, we were responding to Australia was in a conflict in Afghanistan and the means and some of the potential kind of global corruption about what pulled the Allies into that place was pretty hot on the presses, you know, the dossier, trying to remember some of those names like Condoleezza Rice and Tony Blair, and remember those people. the dossier of weapons of mass destruction, all that stuff was the hot topic. And so two things kind of hit me. I struggled with the idea, as one would today, in fact, we look at what's happening in the world right now, to the stage of play in earnest that seemed to be about the grand adventure of war. I just struggled a bit in my conscience with that. And the play does have a celebratory quality. You kind of want to headbutt Henry, for he invades France, he takes troops over there, he wipes out a few villages, and then he ends up at Agincourt with a troop in another sovereign nation from which he is trying to take the crown, making grand, eloquent speeches about how we are the underdogs today and we can come through this, and 10,000 French die defending their own soil. It's kind of hard. It's tough on the conscience, you know. And yet Shakespeare is at pains to point out the futility of war and the way the play ends by going, yay, Henry, what an achievement, look what you did. And all of it was lost and the whole adventure was pointless. He does make that clear at the end. So there was that. So I knew I didn't want to do that version. But the main one I didn't want to do, I'd just seen one at the RSC in England or National or something, where they rolled a tank on stage, where all of the soldiers had proper M16-looking machine guns, full military fatigue. And this chorus who'd kept coming out and telling us, we don't have any props, ladies and gentlemen. We have, you know, we have nothing to work with here. We need to apologise from the top of the plate. Oh, I wish we had this. Oh, I wish we had that. You'll have to excuse that our Battle of Agincourt will be brawl ridiculous, as he calls it, or she calls it. Comes out and tells us that we have none of the means of production. We have a small band of pathetic actors on an unworthy scaffold trying to tell the greatest story, military victory of all time. Can we do that? No, we can't. So we need your imagination. So when I saw so frequently productions that just sort of disavowed every word coming out of the mouth of that chorus, I knew I wanted to kind of lean into that. So I just started researching about the history of that war. That led me to reading a speech by Churchill on the radio where he quoted Henry V, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. And so I dug a little deeper into the Battle of Britain and found this record of these boys that every Thursday night for many months during the Blitz, they were in underground for 71 consecutive nights, and each Thursday night they had a great teacher, and each Thursday night they would perform for the other people in the bomb shelter a play or a comedy skit or a music night. The Glenn Miller Band was down there one night performing in this subway.
Wow.
Incredible. And so every Thursday night, a thing called the Boys Club. And they didn't, unfortunately, the vicar who was sort of diarising that didn't mention what plays they did. But I thought surely they would have told the tale. There must have been some Shakespeare, and he did say there was Shakespeare. And Henry V, the story of a small band of brothers overcoming an impossible odds to win a victory, I thought that would be kind of amazing. So I thought, well, that's an environment where they're trapped in a small space, where they have none of the means of production, where they have nothing but their imaginations, and can they tell a story? And I thought, well, maybe that's a way to have what they think is a boy's own adventure, but is actually, will turn into a dark, brutal Lord of the Flies-like journey into horror, into what human beings are capable of, you know, in the face of war. So that production, I guess, came about through research, essentially.
Yeah, that informs everything, doesn't it?
Yeah,
if you research well enough as an actor, as a creator,
as anything, really. Yeah. I think you probably say it too, but you watch kids trying to develop a performance or a group performance at school or something, and they'll often sit there waiting for someone to have an epiphany. I mean, in fact, just
go out and read.
Just go and read something. Yes. Look at a painting. Listen to a song. You will find your idea.
Yeah,
you know?
Something will be triggered.
Yeah.
You don't only do the Shakespeare repertoire also, you know, The Crucible is a big hit for Sport for Joe, the Miller. So you do look further afield with playwrights.
Yeah, we kind of, I guess because I've done so much Shakespeare and I do it with a range of companies around the country, I do tend to get pigeonholed a little bit with that, and I don't mind that because it is obviously central to what I love. But yeah, we have done quite a few new Australian works. We've done several American works, several Greek plays, French plays. I've written several French adaptations of plays, and so it's kind of, we love, our charter as a company is really just twofold. We want, doesn't matter where the play comes from or when really, we want plays of language, plays where language is sort of the star of the piece, plays where there are challenging big ideas housed within a heightened form of language. This is what personally appeals to me. And secondly, plays of ensemble, plays where a group of people have to work together physically, emotionally to tell a story. That's kind of what enthuses us, I guess, as a company. So this three-hander we're doing at the moment is actually the smallest play we've ever done. We've never done anything like a three-hander before. But it's still a play of heightened language and music, so it sort of appealed to me. But we do find that actors, there are less and less actors on our stages nowadays. The big companies, obviously the great financial, you know, imperative is dangerously difficult in theatre. In Australia, we've watched the way where even back in the days I was at Bell Shakespeare, we would have 15 people in John Bell's ensemble. Mm. Nowadays, they might have 8 or 9 in any major production of Shakespeare at any of the major companies in Australia. You will see, you know, what Kip's been doing at STC with one actor on stage. Like, it's more and more common to have these very small casts. So we think as an indie company, we should be providing opportunities for actors to perform big works because they're so seldom done on the big stages. So we try to we try to kind of look at works, whether it's Cyrano de Bergerac or The Crucible or John Steinbeck's novels or whatever it might be, plays that involve an ensemble, a chance for actors to really work together physically and emotionally as a group is sort of a central tenet of what we do.
Yes, it's something very exciting about seeing a community of actors inhabit a community of characters,
yeah,
a large number on stage.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
that must be a challenge for the traffic controller, the director, to sort of ensure that all those stage images are engaging.
Yeah, that is true. It's hard work, and obviously we rehearse extremely quickly at Sport for Jove so that we can pay people. We often just rehearse for a week, in fact. We don't necessarily advertise that, but many of our plays are rehearsed in a week or 2 weeks from scratch, you know, from go to woe in 5 or 6 days. And there's a thrill in that too, and there's something very Shakespearean about that. He would have handed out the play on Monday morning and they would have been performing it by the Saturday. You kind of get on with it. You know, that's kind of a bit of a rule at Jove. You just get on with it. But yeah, the stage images you can develop though with a big group are kind of thrilling, so I do love that.
Mm. Well, Damien Ryan, thanks for the chat. It's
pleasure.
It's been terrific. Yeah. Chookers for Isolde and Tristan.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Which plays May 1st to June 1st.
That's correct.
At the Alfitz.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Cheers, mate.
Sport for Jove presents Isolde and Tristan by Esther Vilar. It is directed by Damien Ryan. German playwright Esther Vilar's short, brilliantly incisive play is a savage riposte to Wagner's extraordinary opera. How can one of the world's most remarkable, transcendent myths of love be possible? Can we love what we make war with? What are the limits of forgiveness? This clever, atmospheric, sensuous and very funny play speaks to our torn world loudly and clearly. Hovering on a wild sea in the intimacy of the fits, the play combines live soaring opera, stunning music, raw performance, drunkenness, violence and passion. An exceptional cast and a beautiful, brutal story. Thanks for joining us in this episode. You can check out all of the episodes featured in the podcast thus far by scrolling the archive in Apple Podcasts or Spotify. There are over 450 to catch up on. I'm Peter Eyes. Keep well, keep warm, stay safe, and I'll catch you next time on Stages.